The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this week, because of the importance of this particular interview, we're changing the schedule.
Kevin, as we come into this week, we've got the PPI numbers, the CPI numbers, retail sale numbers, and in addition to that, we've got the gap-based financial statements from the U.S. government, which are supposed to be released. And so with a lot of that coming, it's all numbers-based. Wanted to bring John Williams, into the program, and we'll continue the question and answers next week, the last session of that. So tune in next week for the last part of the question and answers.
David, oftentimes in running a company, you bring the controller of the company in, and this is a man who works with the accounting. He has to have accurate data, and he has to give you accurate data. This happens all across the country in businesses that stay alive and stay successful. The numbers really count, even though those meetings not necessarily are the most emotionally charged meetings. They're the ones that keep the company open.
No, in fact, if you think about, you know, the role of a CEO, and in some instances, you're talking about someone who casts vision for the company.
Right.
And is there, unfortunately, in some cases, it's just as a figurehead to represent the board's view of things. And in other cases, they have some real power and influence and are directing things. The CFO, or the controller, as you say, is someone who's constantly looking at the numbers. And
right.
Whether it's sales figures, whether it's inflow, outflow, it's all down to the minutia. And that minutia is actually the guts of the business. It's a measure of how things are doing. Are we doing well, or are we on life support and in need of restructuring? And we wanted to invite John Williams onto the program because in some regards, he's looking at the national accounts the way a CFO would. Okay, well, what's working here? What's not working here? Do we have integrity with the numbers that we're making judgments on the basis of? And if we don't have good numbers in front of us, then we can't make good decisions. So it's paramount that we do the work to make sure that the numbers are accurate before we start coming to conclusions, whether we're talking about economic prognostication or actual investment where hard capital is spent and put on the line.
Well, and you know, David, we have the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We've got a lot of other government agencies that give us numbers. The problem is those numbers are continually changing, and the way they model these things are continually changing. John Williams, our guest coming up, is a man who actually goes back and says, all right, now wait. Before we change that model, let's go ahead and look at what it's really saying.
Kevin, some of these numbers are so important. Just to give you an example, we're looking at a continued contraction at the level of municipal and state authorities. Mm. And what we're looking at is a significant headcount cut, as many as 10 to 11% of all of those employed at the local and state level. That's out of 14 million people. We're talking about a potential loss of an additional 2.2 million jobs.
Well, that's a lot of people.
Well, particularly when you do the numbers and extrapolate and say, okay, well, that's an additional 1.7% added to the already high and rising unemployment number. How will these be factored in? Over the next few months, do we have seasonal biases that take those numbers out, that make them look better than they actually are? John Williams of Shadow Government Statistics joins us today as we explore the week's economic announcements and the larger financial picture as it unfolds between now and, let's pick a point on the horizon, 2014. In the course of this conversation, we'll converge on that date as one of great potential significance. John, in a sentence, where do you see the U.S. economy headed on its present course?
It's heading into a double-dip recession, really an ongoing contraction from what started some years ago.
As we have with past guests, we will today look at both the short-term trends and then try to back up a bit and see how the issues of importance today relate to a larger economic framework, what is antecedent, and also what lies on the horizon. Looking back and looking ahead, we'll ask you, John, to paint a picture with numbers. And Kevin, in this case, you know, painting with numbers reveals a fascinating story which includes political agenda and actually the obfuscation of truth by the statisticians in the employ of venerable groups like the BLS. John is a statistician. For those of our listeners who don't know what he does with shadowstats.com, John is a statistician for years now. He's challenged the notion that numbers generated by Washington and frankly counted on by Wall Street can be taken to the bank. What we find is that John has essentially rolled back the clock to an era where The numbers were more or less the numbers. And models applied to the numbers were not so radically transformative. John, before we explore the numbers being released this week and, of course, the larger economic backdrop, maybe you could illustrate for us, if you will, what has changed over the last 30 years? As statisticians have continued to gather raw data and then generate an interpretation of the data, what's changed in their patterns of interpretation? What gamesmanship is tied to the unemployment number, inflation, GDP, and numbers of that sort?
Well, the changes generally have been methodological, often well advertised, but they've had the effect of putting upside biases into the economic reporting, downside biases into the inflation reporting. That usually has been deliberate for political reasons or for a very specific financial gain of the government in awkward areas such as Social Security payments, where nobody in Congress wants to vote against, let's say, Social Security. Let me take the CPI, for example. When the CPI was first widely used in auto union contracts, the concept of the CPI adjustment for wages was to measure inflation and adjust for inflation a cost of living, of maintaining a constant standard of living. Using a very crude example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics would, let's say, take the price of a pound of beef, gallon of gas, gallon of milk in 1 year, and then it would do the same thing the next year, and however much that package of goods, that fixed package of goods, as they used to call it, however much that had gone up by that, so much your income would have had to have increased in order for you to have stayed even with inflation to have maintained your standard of living, or as an investor, the inflation rate that you would hopefully be beating with your investments. In the early 90s, late 80s, Alan Greenspan and Michael Boskin, who was then head of the Council of Economic Advisors for the first President Bush, started a big campaign about, oh my goodness, the Consumer Price Index overstates inflation. It's costing us a terrible amount of money, because if only inflation were accurately reported, we wouldn't have such big cost of living adjustment increases and Social Security, and that would save the government a lot of money, help balance the deficit.
Was that that time that they began to alter the components within the CPI?
Well, that was their preamble, and they actually, the commission was formed, Congress approved what was done. The concept, when we asked them, why is the CPI overstated, was it, well, if steak gets too expensive, people will start buying more hamburger. And if they buy more hamburger, then they have a lower cost of living. Well, that might be true in general terms, but that's not a cost of living that's maintaining a constant standard of living. That's a declining standard of living if you have to buy hamburger because you can't afford steak. So it completely abrogated the concept of having a measure that reflected a constant standard of living. There were changes made to the CPI. They started to put in a substitution, sort of like the hamburger-steak comparison, but it was done in several areas. They reweighted the series more frequently. They put in geometric weighting of the elements of the CPI, and the geometric weighting, whatever goes up in price gets a lower weighting in the series, and anything that goes down in price automatically gets a higher weighting. There were a number of other changes as well. Some of them go back before this period of time, all with the same general approach, that they had to bring down the CPI. The effect was, had the changes not been made that have been made in this effort to drive down the payments and cost of living for Social Security, had those changes not been made, Social Security checks, it would be at least double what they are now. So it's been very effective. And you just recently saw the President's Deficit Commission come out with a suggestion that they replace all the cost of living adjustments that are currently based on the CPI with what they call the chained CPI. That's a fully substitution-based index. It would actually reduce the level of reported inflation even more, help to cut the cost of living adjustments. But again, it's completely separate from the concept of the CPI as most people look at it. What do I need to keep my standard of living in place?
So again, to state that there was this methodological switch, and on the one hand, the methodological switch was to create an upside bias in economic statistics and a downside bias in inflation numbers. You're saying basically that that was to save them more money.
In terms of the CPI, it was designed to help reduce very specifically cost of living adjustments to the entitlement programs, because nobody in Congress
Correct.
Wanted to vote against those programs. But by changing the CPI, they could effectively reduce the cost. And if you have lower inflation, some of the same principles here were applied across the board with gross domestic product. This is a measure of the broadest measure of the government's economic activity. It is generally reported adjusted for inflation. So the lower the rate of inflation you used to deflate the nominal activity, the current dollar activity, the way most people would look at the economy.
Well, if you're understating inflation, aren't you overstating your GDP number?
Yes, that's right. So it has that direct effect.
So what about unemployment? Because that's certainly one of the deep wounds in the economy today. You know, we've got a variety of things that they've used to sort of bludgeon that number, whether it's seasonal factors, the birth-death models. Maybe you could talk a little bit about renaming that has occurred, again, sort of changing a concept. You know, maybe some of our listeners don't know what a discouraged worker is.
Sure.
But if you could contrast U3, U6, and then tell us a little bit about the shadow government stats alternate unemployment number and kind of put unemployment in its proper context for us.
There are two surveys that are published each month. One is the household survey, which gives you the unemployment rate. The other is the what they call the establishment survey, which takes account of and a sampling of corporate payroll employment. In terms of the unemployment rate, if you were to go around survey anyone in the country, are you employed or unemployed, he or she'd get right back to you and say yes or no. It doesn't take too much to figure that out. Most people have a pretty solid opinion as to whether or not they're unemployed. If you did that across the country, you'd come up with a higher rate of unemployment than the government reports. And it's because the government has different definitions in the way of looking at this than many people might. The government publishes six levels of unemployment. It is based on a survey where they hit 60,000 households a month. Doesn't matter if anyone's receiving unemployment benefits or not. It's based on the question as to whether employed or unemployed. If they're unemployed, are they willing and able to work? And have they been actively looking for work? Specifically, have they looked for work in the last 4 weeks? If they answer all those questions, yes, they get counted as unemployed. And those who are employed and those who are then counted officially as unemployed make up the labor force, and it's the number of unemployed divided by the labor force that gives you the unemployment rate. The third level of unemployment, that's called U3, is a headline number. That's the one that right now is at 9.8%. And that's where it's defined that you've been out actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. There are, however, a number of people who have given up looking for work or have not looked for work in the last 4 weeks, but maybe have looked for work in the last year. They can't find any work where they are, but they do want to work. They're willing and able to work. They just haven't been able to find a job. Government refers to them as discouraged workers and includes them in its broadest unemployment rate measure, which is called U6. It includes discouraged workers. It includes other marginally attached workers and people who are forced to work part-time because they cannot find a full-time job. That U6 unemployment rate is up at 17%. Well, that is, I think, a better indication of how the employment market looks. It has changed in its definitions over time. Back in 1994, the entire unemployment surveying system was revamped, and they changed the question on a discouraged worker. It used to be if you were really willing and able to work but had given up looking for work because there was no work to be had, you were just counted as a discouraged worker. Well, there was no time limit. They didn't cut you off if you hadn't looked for work in the last year. So those that hadn't look for work now in more than a year. They keep dropping off the counts here. Government doesn't count you anymore. I refer to them as the long-term discouraged workers. I run my own estimates on that, and if you add them back in on top of the U6, it would take unemployment up to over 22%, which I think is what you'd get if you went around the country and asked everyone, are you employed or not? I say 22%, then people say, oh my goodness, I understand that in the Great Depression, the peak unemployment was 25%. That was the estimate for 1933, but the government didn't start counting unemployment till 1940, and that estimate 1933 reflected an environment where 27% of the population worked on farms. Today, less than 2% of the population works on farms, and if you looked at what they estimated as non-farm unemployment back in the Great Depression at its peak, that was up in the 34-35% range. I think that's a number that would be more comparable with what I'm looking at. What I'm seeing now is it's as bad as it's been in the post-World War II era. but it's not as bad as the Great Depression. Granted, the contraction that we're in, the economic downturn, is the most severe that we've seen since the Great Depression, and certainly the longest.
John, to repeat something you recently penned, this is from your December 3rd report on employment and unemployment. You say that modern economic reporting never was designed to handle an ongoing economic catastrophe. Unfortunately, the collapse of reporting quality with a number of key series has coincided with a period where accurate and meaningful economic reporting could not be more important. Yeah, that's from your December 3rd report.
Right.
So what you're basically saying is that even though these numbers have in them inaccuracies in terms of the reflection of the real state of affairs, whether it's unemployment, the inflation, as we talked about, the CPI components and their alteration through the years, the GDP figures and how those are actually very fluid. If you change inflation, you inadvertently change GDP. You're saying that even the way these numbers were configured, faulty as they are, they cannot work and do not work in the context of an economic malaise like we have today. So I guess, what are the consequences for an investing community running with the assumption that these numbers coming from Washington are a true reflection? What are the consequences?
Well, the concept is you can be very easily misled, particularly when you have people hyping the latest number for whatever positive content it may have. There's a certain desperation within the Fed, within the financial community, to try and keep things as positive here as possible in the financial market, but the economy has not recovered. It's getting worse, and unfortunately, things ahead are not particularly bright. In terms of what you cited there, let me give you a very specific example with the payroll employment, which is the other big number that moves the markets when they come out with the unemployment rate. There you have a circumstance. The government's usually pretty open about what they're doing. They have footnotes. They have special reports. They explain why they're doing different things, at least to a certain extent. With the payroll survey, which is based on reporting of companies on how many people they have employed at a certain point in the month, the government has no ability to count businesses that fail and don't report, or the number of businesses that are starting up and starting to employ people. And what they did some years ago was to assume that the number of companies going out of business and the people who lost their jobs there was more than offset by the creation of new companies and people gaining jobs there. And that's an assumption that generally might have some validity in a positive economy. But here we have the worst downturn since the Great Depression, and it's absolutely wrong. This is what they call the birth-death model, in fact, because of the happy assumptions about how many jobs are created. Beyond that offset, they add another 500,000 plus jobs a year, which are an upside bias factor, just a plug number, because that's what they feel they're missing. With the sharp contraction that you have in this cycle, the downturn started, you had an absolute plunge in economic activity, and then a protracted period of bottom bouncing that's gone on for almost 2 years. You had a little bit of an up bump as some stimulus factors went through the system. But we're beginning to see some of the key numbers turning down again, including the employment numbers, including industrial production. Again, this is not over. But what happens with the Bureau of Labor Statistics and their payroll data is that each year they go back and they take a physical count from the filings of state unemployment taxes and estimate actual employment from that, and then they compare it with their estimates from their survey. What they found was in 2009, they were, by the time they published the estimate, that they had overestimated payroll levels by over a million jobs.
Oops.
They've already announced that for 2010, the benchmark month, which is March of 2010, they'd overestimated by about 370,000 jobs. And by the time they work it out in the current reporting and they publish it in February, that's going to be over 600,000 jobs that are going to be knocked off what's been previously reported. And you take those jobs out of there, a lot of that little bit of an upside blip that you had disappears too. It's a problem they have with a reporting system. You take the monthly number that I think last month was up 39,000 or something like that.
That's right.
That has a margin of error of plus or minus 129,000 around it. So that anyone who's looking at these numbers really shouldn't take them too seriously. The markets take them too seriously. My goodness, if you come in 10,000 or above or below the market expectation on the payrolls, you can see gyrating markets. That's nonsense. There are a lot of people, as traders, like to see a volatility. That's how they make money. But for the average guy, you try to live on the day-to-day hype, you're not getting an accurate picture of what's happening.
Well, like this week, we're seeing the sales figures thrown out, and it's a positive number.
Today's retail sales.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, again, you have to have a sense, too, of what you're looking at. The retail sales has the same seasonal factor problem that you have with the payroll numbers, where, and I guess it had been touched upon under an earlier comment. All the numbers that come out monthly are seasonally adjusted. You have regular patterns of activity that maybe go with the school year or the holiday shopping season, and the government tries to take those seasonal patterns out. Over the period of a year, the numbers have to total up, whether they're seasonally adjusted or unadjusted. But with if the seasonal adjustments are done properly, then what you see in the month-to-month change is an indication of economic activity. Recently, and both the payrolls and retail sales have gone to what they call concurrent seasonal factor adjustment. Each month, they recalculate the seasonal factors going all the way back in time. And if the system were stable, you wouldn't see much volatility. I mean, once a number would be set, it should be pretty much the same for a while in terms of that, how much of an adjustment you make, let's say, for November. But what we're seeing is significant revisions month to month. And the reason that's happening is that you no longer have the regular seasonal adjustment patterns. The way they would work it is they take, let's say, the last 5 years of data, they'd look at the patterns there, and then they'd estimate the regular pattern, and from that they'd work the seasonal factors. Last 3 years, you have had no regular seasonal patterns. You've had a plunging economic activity. You look at retail sales, and auto sales are an important part of that. You've had the bankruptcy of two of the big three automakers. You've had disruptions in production cycles, plant closings. There's no way you can get normal seasonal factors here. And again, we're not seeing meaningful numbers as a result. I wouldn't want to bet anything on them. I can tell you there's a good reason for thinking they're not too good. And another factor with the retail sales to look at is how it is net of inflation, because if you see inflation picking up, which is what Mr. Bernanke is rooting for, that's reflected as a gain in retail sales.
That was my question this morning, looking at the retail sales figures. Gasoline stations, yeah, of the contribution to the change, 0.4 out of the 0.9, came from gasoline stations. I can only assume that that's revenues from gasoline and not an increase in candy bar sales.
That's right. The same thing true with grocery stores. So, I mean, over half this morning's reported gain was due to higher inflation.
Well, let's then go to the big picture on that, because you've been quite clear over the last year that inflation and even hyperinflation is an outcome with a growing probability. What kind of inflation? One with or without growth in the economy? And the only reason I mention that, I'm very interested in what you see is a differing complexion in this particular inflationary period. I read an article by Jeremy Siegel this morning, and he conflates economic growth with inflation, that in fact they're inexorably tied. And if you have inflation, that's a positive sign because the economy is growing. Is that your view of inflation, or what kind of inflation, hyperinflation, do you see potentially playing out over the next few years?
Well, the concept that inflation always means strong economic growth is absolute nonsense. And again, the Fed is not giving the American people a straight story on why it's doing its quantitative easing. If it says, oh, we're going to create inflation, and that means strong growth, that's a very simplistic approach, and shame on the very good economists who work at the Fed, and including Mr. Bernanke. They know better. You can have inflation. The type of inflation you want to have, if you're going to have inflation, is one that's driven by a strong business environment. Demand is so strong, supply can't keep up with it, and prices rise. That's a happy environment. People are employed. People are making money. But you also have circumstances where you may have non-economic factors or non-economic demand factors driving the inflation, such as we had back in 1973 with the oil crisis. We had an inflationary recession then, 73-75, one of the worst post-war downturns. We saw some of that a little bit in the last year or two, and what's happening here, and what Bernanke has already accomplished in his open a move to debase the dollar. You go back to 2002 when he talked about how he could fight a depression, or not a depression, a deflation. This is as a Fed governor before his Fed chairman, his famous helicopter speech. He indicated that the central bank, in coordination with the central government, always could debase the dollar and effectively create inflation. And the part of the process might involve jawboning, that even the indicating that the Fed would do that could start to have that effect. And indeed, it has. We'll be seeing tomorrow a report on the Consumer Price Index. I don't know where it's going to come in. The expectations are reasonably low. I wouldn't be, it was 0.2% or something like that. I wouldn't be too surprised if it were above that. But one thing that you'll see there is higher gasoline prices. To this morning's producer price index, up 0.8%, was stronger than expected due to gasoline, due to energy prices, food prices, and increasing automobile cost. What's happened here is that at first the initial talking about this new so-called quantitative easing, which is really a euphemism for the Fed's monetizing the U.S. Treasury debt in terms of what they're doing at the moment. The jawboning and then starting the actual action both had the effect of hitting the dollar. Foreign investors didn't want to hold the dollar. You saw movement into gold anticipating higher inflation. You saw movement out of the dollar. Then we had a euro crisis, which bumped the dollar up a little bit on a relative basis. But long-term problem here is the dollar is being debased. It's being driven lower. Effect, you take a dollar-denominated commodity such as oil. A weakening dollar will result in higher oil prices. Higher oil prices yield higher gasoline prices. You go back to the peak of the financial crisis when the dollar was troughing and oil was up over $140 and gasoline was pushing $5 a gallon. We were beginning to see a pickup of an inflation there that had nothing to do with a demand-driven economy. It was all tied to the monetary distortions of the Fed at that time, liquefying the system, trying to prevent a collapse of the banking system, savaging the dollar. Then the dollar was reversed, and I think a lot of that very deliberately so. Oil prices came down, and that gave you the big ups and downs in the CPI. But now we're in a situation, we're in a long-term depreciation of the dollar. You're seeing rising commodity prices due to the monetary policy of the Fed, and it's due to the dollar debasement. It's not due to strong domestic demand. And that's the worst of all worlds from a financial standpoint.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
Well, as we look at quantitative easing, too, let's look at what it's been advertised as doing and whether or not they can actually accomplish this, because the intention is to either monetize directly excess treasuries that are being floated and the market does not want, or go to banks and liquefy their holdings, taking those treasuries off their balance sheet, giving them cash in return, cash that's created out of nothing, in the hopes that they'll take those cash reserves and lend them out at a higher interest rate than what they're being paid by having reserves there at the treasury. So what is it exactly that is at issue here? Monetization or velocity of money? Because we know that they will continue to monetize. What happens if velocity of money actually picks up significantly in here and the liquidity which has been created to the tune of trillions of dollars is now through our fractional reserve banking system multiplied many fold, not just the 2 or 3 trillion, which is outstanding, but now again with a normal money multiplier, let's call it 15 or 30 trillion. Is that a reasonable assumption?
I mean, something like that could happen, sure. I mean, it requires some shifting of what's happening in the system now, but now the Fed, unlike its first round of what they called quantitative easing, which basically was a bank bailout, was aimed at buying primarily mortgage-backed securities. What you have to keep in mind here is that this financial crisis that we're now into the third year of, is something that was triggered initially by a downturn in the economy, even a little bit before what the National Bureau of Economic Research recognizes as the onset of the recession. The downturn there started to hit the housing market, which triggered all sorts of problems with some of the collateralized securities. But when you saw the panic, when you saw the urging of the Fed and the government for this big stimulus package, there really was a risk of systemic collapse of the banking system. Shouldn't have gotten to that point in time, terrible mismanagement, federal government level and at the Federal Reserve. But we were at that point, A collapse of the system would have represented ultimate failure for both the Fed. The Federal Reserve is an element of the federal government. It's a private corporation owned by the banking system. It does have some federal government oversight, and it does have some federal government mandates, but its primary function is to maintain the solvency of the banking system. That's their primary goal. That's their primary fear. They didn't want the system to collapse. They did everything they could. They spent every penny they could. They created whatever money they had to in order to keep the system afloat. And in keeping the system afloat, the banks are in such poor shape. They generally have kept most of their excess reserves that were created from this on deposit with the Fed. The reason they're not lending money, I mean, the sensible banks say, oh, we can't find credit-worthy customers. That's nonsense. I know a number of people who are credit-worthy that are having trouble getting money from a bank. The reason the banks are not lending money is that the system still largely is in crisis, tremendous solvency risks there. And I think that's why Bernanke is moving towards this new liquefaction of the system. He's still addressing a banking crisis that has maybe been put in abeyance, been swept under the rug a little bit, but is still there. On top of that, he has an economy now that is turning down. All the good news ahead of us in terms of how the budget could be brought under control, this is beginning to fade into the background. But everything that had people saying, yes, we'll back you, Fed, we'll back you, U.S. government, we're going to hold your dollars for you, was based on underlying assumptions that there's going to be a recovery, that we'd be seeing fairly decent economic growth this year or next. Instead, we're seeing ongoing contraction, a deepening downturn, which means the federal budget deficit is going to be much worse than expected. We're already seeing signs of that out of Washington. It means the Treasury fundings are going to explode beyond expectation. It means that foreign investors are not going to want to hold the dollars, and it puts the Fed in a position where even if they hadn't started what they started in terms of monetizing the Treasury debt, they would soon be forced into doing exactly that, with the effect, as you suggested, of starting to explode the money supply. As the foreigners start dumping the dollar, as you see gasoline prices rise, Fed's keeping interest rates low. If you've got money and the best you can do with a so-called safe investment in a treasury is lower than the rate of inflation, particularly if you think inflation's running around 5%, which is what I find most of the people I deal with are looking at, you do better to spend that money, go out and buy things that'll be rising in price because you'll make more money on that than by holding the cash or investing it. This is where you start to see the increase in the velocity of the money. No one wants to hold the dollars. And it's indeed the velocity and the magnitude of the money out there that will help to feed the inflation going forward. I'm talking about a hyperinflation. And the reason for this, more than anything else, is that over the decades, the federal government has put the government in a circumstance that it already effectively is bankrupt. If you look at the financial statements that are published each year now based on generally accepted accounting principles, and there's a statement that in theory is going to be published in the next day or so for 2010. But up through 2009, we've been seeing an actual federal deficit using accrual accounting, looking at the year-to-year change in the net present value of the unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare. You're seeing an annual deficit in the $4 to $5 trillion range. Putting that into perspective, if you wanted to bring that into balance in a given year and do so by raising taxes, you could take 100% of people's income. You could take 100% of corporate profits. You'd still be in deficit. Let's say you wanted to cut government spending to bring that in line. You could cut every penny of government spending except for Social Security and Medicare, and you'd still be in deficit. Social Security and Medicare programs have to be severely slashed in order for the system to be solvent going forward. There's no political will in Washington for that to happen. I just see that as a political impossibility. And you look at what happened this last month with the deficit commission's recommendations, how that they were handled, how people looked at them. Even the deficit commission was not targeting the gap-based deficit. They were just targeting the cash-based deficit, which is the way the numbers usually get reported, where it was going a couple hundred billion until we had the crisis that spiked it up over a trillion. They wanted to get it back to a couple of hundred billion a year. That would not solve the circumstance. The effect is that over time, the government does not have the ability to fund its obligations. It cannot raise enough taxes. And most governments that find themselves in that position take care of it by revving up the printing presses and print the money they need to cover the obligations, and that creates the hyperinflation. So that if you were talking to me 5 years ago, I would have been talking about a hyperinflation by the end of this decade. As the crisis broke and the way things were handled there, I've moved my estimate into 2014, and as we're now in a circumstance where you have an intractable downturn with a Fed that is already moving to debase the dollar, you're at risk of seeing the early stages of a hyperinflation breaking the middle of next year. What you have to look out for is the dollar. It's all very closely tied to the dollar, the foreign holdings of the dollar. Foreign investors start to dump it. They start to dump the dollar-denominated assets. The Fed has no real political option other than to step in and monetize that, and you're off to the races.
As we've discussed with our listeners in past weeks, one of the most significant days of this year was when the QE2 was announced. It happened to coincide or overlap with the G20 meeting in Seoul, South Korea, and those at the G20 meeting looked very candidly at what was being done and read it exactly as you've described, as a continuation of a dollar debasement theme. And whereas the monetization of mortgage-backed securities in QE1 may have been justified for the sake of systemic solidity, this is nothing but paying back debts that are owed to those G20 participants with cheaper dollars. In essence, it's the early stages of default. Not your typical sovereign default scenario, but in most sovereign default scenarios, as we've discussed before, you have foreign-denominated debt, whereas this is all U.S.-denominated debt. So it's not that we have to stop paying. We can continue to make payments on our debt. It's just going to be with cheaper and cheaper dollars, which brings us to exactly what you said. The fact that debt is a defining characteristic of our age and the fact that we have a currency crisis immediately in front of us, they're connected. They're absolutely connected. And watching behavior in the currency markets, particularly as it pertains to the dollar, will be the touchstone. So it's interesting, as we look at this 2010 financial report coming from the U.S. government, let's shift back to that just momentarily. How do you think they'll account for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
I don't know. They should have it on the books. And if they do, you're going to see a sharp deterioration in the financial statement. We'll be analyzing it on our website, and we'll look at the numbers both before and after one-time adjustments. But I can tell you that there's nothing here that's improving. There's nothing in the works that suggests it's going to improve. And in terms of the economy, even if you had a positive economy now, you can't get the economy growing strong enough to grow out of this issue. But we have an economy right now that's impaired with a structural change that's reflected in a lack of income among the average household. Average household today cannot keep up with inflation. That's shown in the government's numbers. And income can't keep up with inflation. Consumption growth is not going to keep up with inflation either. Consumption is the biggest part of personal consumption's 70% now of GDP. And the GDP is measured, again, adjusted for inflation. So you're not going to see any growth in the economy based on the income growth. There's a way you can do that temporarily, and that's by having people take on added debt. And Greenspan was aware of that. He knew this a decade or so ago, and that's why he was encouraging people to take on debt and to encourage leverage, build upon leverage. And really, the debt growth has been what's fueled the economic growth for the last decade. Now the debt system, to a certain extent, has collapsed. You don't have the option open to consumers to expand debt the way they used to. And the combination of the lack of debt growth and lack of income growth, there's just no way that the consumer can support a positive GDP at this point.
Are you pretty much ruling out a deflationary collapse with debt contracting and that having been the primary source of our growth over the last decade, as you said? Talk to us about the collapse of M3, what that pretends, and whether or not a deflationary outcome can be ruled out at this point.
I would rule it out so long as we have people in Washington who are looking to prevent a systemic collapse. If they allow a systemic collapse in the form that you had back in the 30s, where major institutions fail and and such. I guess in theory you could have a deflation. Don't see them doing that. Their actions, every action up to date has been to
inflate.
Inflate to keep the system afloat. You may have a Congress that turns against this concept, but the Fed is beyond congressional control at this point, and they can do anything that they want there.
Well, and you've already pointed out that they are not a government entity. There exists a conflict of interest wherein they essentially are looking to the banking community and its long-term health over virtually anything else.
Collapsing debt does not necessarily lead to deflation or even a collapse in the money supply. If I'm a bank and I lend you $1 million, you go out, you spend $1 million. You run into trouble, you say, bank, I can't pay you back $1 million. I say, I want my $1 million back. I can't go into the system and pull back out of the system $1 million that you spent. I end up writing it off. So if I could pull that $1 million out of the system, that would contract the money supply, but I can't do that. I write it off, it impairs my balance sheet, I have to reduce my lending, and it is a lower lending. It's the decline in lending as loans roll over that has led to the decline in the money supply. It hasn't been the actual debt collapse per se, but it's the aftershock of that and what it's done to the lending system. Looking at the M3 numbers, and I still publish or estimate and publish M3 largely based on Fed reporting, we're seeing year-to-year contraction, worst year-to-year contraction since about the post-World War II era. You'd look at that and say, yep, that's deflationary. And if we were Zimbabwe, where we had effectively a contained system and the Zimbabwe dollar didn't circulate outside, the U.S. dollar didn't circulate outside the U.S., that would probably be the case. But in the case of the U.S., we have here the world's reserve currency. We have outside the country, outside our internal system where you count the money supply, an overhang of about $7 trillion of liquid dollars that could be dumped into the U.S. at a moment's notice. And when you're looking at the money supply, you have to look at that as well. And that's been affected by what the Fed's doing, looking at the money supply in terms of the inflationary implications. And as long as people are happy with what they're holding, it has a neutral effect. But if they start dumping, watch it. We've got a terrible risk of a big upside shock in the money supply there, in addition to what may be looming with the U.S. banks if someone forces them to lend.
Take us through the scenario. We see an increase in inflation. 70% of our debt comes due over the next 5 years, Treasury paper, that is. And so to some degree, we can assume that not all of it will be bought on top of current funding needs. We've got the rollover stuff as well. And so the monetization gets kicked into high gear.
Right. The Fed effectively will be buying the Treasury debt, creating the money. But that becomes hyperinflation. This isn't going to last 5 years as I see it. As that happens, well, the way I define a hyperinflation is crude. I don't use a number of zeros or whatever, and there are all sorts of variations of what a hyperinflation is. Very simply, when you find that the largest denomination note in circulation before the inflation becomes worth more as toilet paper or kindling for a fire, you have an inflation, a hyperinflation. I'm looking at a circumstance here where the dollar becomes virtually worthless. And as scary a circumstance as that is, consider this. The worst hyperinflation anyone's ever seen was in Zimbabwe. I mean, if you took a pile of the original $2 bills and then put those, the equivalent of what would have been $2 bills in its final iteration, it would have reached from the Earth to the Andromeda galaxy, literally light years long. There are not enough trees on Earth to print the notes. That took place over a couple of years, yet the country functioned, the economy functioned. The reason it was able to function was that there was a black market in U.S. dollars. People would get their domestic currency, immediately convert it to U.S. dollars. That stabilized their purchasing power, and then they could function. We have no such backup system here in the United States.
What's the black market in if it's not in U.S. dollars? In fact, if the dollar hyperinflation, even if it's not as severe as Zimbabwe, how do we function? What is that black market in? I mean, a part of this is getting to the question of, you know, what does wealth preservation look like in this environment? We're not talking about a permanent state of affairs, but one that on a temporary basis is enough to wipe you out for a lifetime.
Right. Simply, I look at, indeed, a circumstance here where I'd be looking to preserve wealth and assets, forget about the near-term gyrations in the markets, using physical gold and silver as primary hedges. I'd also look at getting some currency outside the U.S., Australian dollars, Canadian dollars, Swiss francs. I I think they're generally going to do fairly well here, getting some assets outside the United States. There are ways of protecting your assets, riding through what's going to be a very difficult time. And as things start to stabilize, as they will, and you know, people who've been able to maintain their assets and liquidity will have all sorts of extraordinary opportunities. But also because of this, the unusual nature of something like this in our system, which is so heavily electronically dependent, has no black market people can deal in at the moment, you're likely going to devolve into some kind of a barter system. It may take a while for that to happen, so that you also have to look not only at preserving your wealth and assets, but the safety of yourself and your family. I'd look to have a store of goods that you'd need for a couple of months, which as much as you might have. I'm a real crazy guy. I'm out here sitting on the Hayward Fault in California. I know there's going to be a major earthquake here in the not-too-distant future. I mean, it might be a couple of decades, but it could be tomorrow. So, I mean, just from the standpoint of a natural disaster, I have a store of canned goods, water, things like that. This man-made disaster is really sort of a parallel. I mean, don't get stuff that you can't recycle and use, and look to have some things for barter. One fellow I talked with who'd been through a hyperinflation in South America said the thing he'd found that worked best for small change. I mean, if you have a 1 ounce gold coin, that's sort of tough if you want to go and buy bread at the grocery store, was to have small bottles of airline sized bottles of high quality scotch. If you don't drink scotch or don't drink, get stuff that you would use, consume, just in case. Hopefully I'm completely wrong here as to what's happening, but if you have it, it can enable you to come through this as well as anybody can.
John, just for perspective, and this is, we've heard this more than once, when one of my colleagues visited Klaus Bucher in New York City, he was the manager of VanEck's World Income Fund, you know, this goes back over 15 years, sat with this man who had been through the German hyperinflation, and the way that their family, a teetotaling family, had gotten through the hyperinflation was the stock of vodka that they had in their basement, which was a tradable commodity, and that's the only way that they survived financially. It's interesting that you mention that. It certainly ties in with historical precedent, as you say, the gentleman in South America. I guess for most Americans and our listening audience as well, and it's almost hard to concede the defeat of the U.S. dollar and the dollar-centric monetary regime, because it's something that has never happened in our lifetime. And it's almost as if we believe that it cannot happen because we cannot imagine it happening, and we cannot imagine it happening if we've not seen it already, which is really the opposite side of imagination. Imagination is not necessarily tied to reality or something that you've known previously.
What you're saying there is true, but it has happened in slow motion. If you go back to the point in time where Roosevelt abandoned the domestic gold standard, the dollar's lost in excess of 95% of its purchasing power. It has happened. I'm looking at this in a very short period of time.
Correct.
Not over 70 years. This is the type of thing that can happen over several months.
So the Keynesian monetary policy of gradual expansion of the money supply, he's right. It does work as long as you can keep it at an imperceptible level. We're just at a point in time, given our balance sheet, where things are about to speed up in terms of the dollar devaluation and currency crisis. Instead of a 50, 60, 70-year period, it may be a 5, 6, 7-month period in which acute pain is experienced.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to, as we always do, reading your reports. Would encourage our listeners to visit shadowstats.com and look at the invaluable work that John's been doing for years now, and by all means, subscribe to his service. Shadowstats.com, John Williams, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, David, that was a fascinating interview. You know, that government report that's coming out is going to be very interesting. Let's go ahead and keep that on the front burner for the next few programs.
Yeah, Kevin, the U.S. Treasury gap-based 2010 financial report will tell us a lot, I think. And there's going to be more than us looking at it. You've got Moody's, which is considering a downgrade on U.S. debt if this tax deal goes through because of the fiscal implications. It adds to pressure on our balance sheet. At this point, we are really at a breaking point in terms of both our debt levels and the stability of our currency. And so we need to be looking at every possible detail that implies weakness and strength, knowing that our foreign creditors are doing the exact same thing.
So, David, what you're saying is we may not have a very merry Christmas as far as the numbers go.
Well, we'll have to see.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, John Williams of ShadowStats.com. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can give us a call anytime during business hours at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.